Hi, Greg Barth, back with you on another edition of Noir on the Radio. And joining me for this round are authors Krista Faust and Gary Phillips. And they're here to talk about their comic series, Peepland, which is published by Hard Case Crime and Titan Comics. So a little about our guests. Krista Faust is the author of several novels, including Chokehold, Money Shot, and Hoodtown. Money Shot was nominated for an Edgar Award, Anthony Award, and Barry Award, and won a Spine Tingler Award in the Rising Star category. She worked in the Times Square peep booths as a professional dominatrix and in the adult film industry, both behind and in front of the cameras for over a decade, starring in dozens of racy fetish-oriented videos. She also wrote and directed a four-part bondage adventure serial called Dita in Distress, featuring world-famous burlesque queen Dita Von Teese. Faust is a film noir fanatic and an avid reader of classic hard-boiled pulp novels and an MMA fight fan. She lives and writes in Los Angeles. And our other guest, born under a bad sign with family roots in one of the oldest towns in Texas in the Mississippi Delta, Gary Phillips must keep writing to forestall his appointment at the crossroads. In addition to Peepland, his short story, The Two Falcons, in the highway kind, tells of fast cars, desperate drivers, and dark roads, was recently optioned by Legendary Entertainment. His first ever Sherlock Holmes story, Martin X, is in Echoes of Sherlock Holmes, stories inspired by the Holmes canon. And with Robert J. Randisi, Phillips co-edited the recent anthology 44 Caliber Funk, Tales of Crime, Soul, and Payback. He teaches at Antioch University's MFA Creative Writing Program. So we're still waiting for Krista to join us tonight. We'll bring her on the line when she is able to connect with us. But Gary Phillips, welcome to Noir on the Radio. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Well, if you could, Gary, kind of set up Peepland for our listeners tonight. Maybe just give us a, you know, brief introduction to what the series is and who it's about.
Well, Peepland is set in the kind of last bad old days of New York's Times Square. This our story takes place over 1 week between Christmas and New Year's Eve in the late 80s. 86, the end of 86, in that area. And this is still, at that time, this was still an area where you could find the peep booths and the grindhouse and the triple X theaters and the old men in raincoats with stubble on their face and all that. And actually, it's an area of town that Krista, when she gets here, will talk about because she actually worked as a teenager, in that area. It's an area that I only knew as a visitor, occasional visitor to New York, and only tangentially, only on the surface. But it's a great setting for our crime story, and not to give too much away. But our main character, Roxy Bell, is a 19-year-old kind of punk kid, young woman who works in one of the peep booths. And our story begins kind of like all great classic, I think, crime stories begins, particularly, I think, crime films set in that era in New York City with a guy running down the street for his life. And he ducks into Peepland. That Peepland is the name of our particular peep show emporium, and leaves something in Roxy's booth, and that sets in motion the plot.
Well, yeah, it's a wonderfully rich setting for, you know, for a story like this. Who had the idea, you know, for this project, making it?
Oh, this
a,
is all
a comic
this is
series?
All Krista's idea. That area of Times Square, 42nd Street, was called The Deuce, and actually originally that was our title, but we thought that Peepland was a little bit more evocative and a bit more told the casual reader who might just be glancing at an ad or hear about it, something, giving them a little bit more about what this story was about. And Krista actually had originally written a screenplay that she gave to me and a few other folks, you know, for some feedback. And then in the context of that, as we started to talk about it more, And then the opportunity came about with Hard Case Crime, because she's written, as you mentioned, a couple of her books have been with Hard Case Crime, Chokehold in particular, and Hard Case Crime was branching out or is branching out into the world of comics through Titan, which is a UK publisher. And so the opportunity came to do a story for the Hard Case Crime comics line, and so it seemed only proper, or seemed only natural then that she would take what she had fleshed out in that screenplay, and we kind of readapted it then to the comic book form.
And have you guys have the two of you worked together before, or how did you decide to collaborate together on this project?
Well, no, the funny thing is Chris and I have known each other for a while, and we've read each other's work, and we've hung out some, but this was the first time that we worked together, and really she just sort of asked me along for the ride, only because I've worked some in comics before and was more familiar with the format of comics, but you know, Chris is a fast learner, so that's not, so it wasn't like remedial starting blocks and you know, we were starting way back from zero. It was, we were, you know, hit the ground running, and once we had doped out some of the particulars from her script, and then we had sort of then added some material and changed some things around for the comics format, and once we had our synopsis and felt good about our story and thought, you know, we had some good characters and had some nice twists and turns in the plot. And once it got approved, and, you know, with a few tweaks, you know, we were off and running.
Yeah, you know, I like how Krista, and, you know, one of the, I think it may be the second issue of People, and she talks about how this is by far the most autobiographical project that she's written yet, and just, you know, kind of the, her experiences, how it shaped Roxy Bell, and you had you know, kind of an essay in one of the issues as well. Can you talk about, you know, you and your experiences back in 1986, and maybe a little about some of the background for the character Lorenzo in People Inc.?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. You know, we appropriated or were inspired by several incidents in of infamy, I suppose is the way to say it, in New York, or recent New York history. And one of them was the case of the Central Park Five, where these five young black and brown young men were railroaded into prison over decades, and then were finally exonerated through DNA testing, and so we use a little bit of that that story, or we adapt that story for the, in the case of Lorenzo, who was Aisha, who was one of the other booth workers with Roxy, when the young man gets swept up in an incident that happens in Central Park, and then gets entangled, ensnared in the criminal justice system. But again, you know, we didn't want to, you know, make a big preachy point about all this, but just to sort of give you, give folks a kind of context and a kind of setting, a kind of verisimilitude for how these incidents can happen. And then if you don't have enough money, and if you don't have the right lawyer, et cetera, how these things can snowball. So, that was a particular incident, I live in Los Angeles, but that, I remember that particular case was vivid because that was a national case. And for me in the 80s, because I'm the old guy, you know, I have a background as a community organizer and I've done, I don't know, a lot of different things. And I think in 86, I know what I was doing in 86. In 86, me and my buddy, we had a small print shop, so we were printers then, but we kind of were on these little lefty printers, I guess, here in L.A. And so I was doing that, doing this sort of blue-collar job, as well as then doing some organizing or some community activist work at night, because we were I would say we were printers to the left. That's a little bit grandiose, but because we came from that community, we got a lot of our work through you know, doing flyers and things like that. This is way in the days before, of course, file sharing and PDFs and all that.
Hello, boys.
Yeah.
Hey, there she is.
Hi, is this Krista?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Hey, no worries. Welcome to Noir on the Radio. You've got Greg and Gary here. We've just been talking through People and a little bit for our audience.
Thanks for jumping for me. I apologize.
Hey, no problem. Hey, so Krista, question for you. Now, I read in that first issue, or maybe the second issue of People, and you said that this was by far the most autobiographical project you've written yet. Can you tell us about your experience, you know, where you were in 1986 and what extent Roxy Bell is shaped by your own experiences?
Yeah, you bet. Well, I grew up on 45th Street and 9th Avenue, which is just west of Times Square. And I worked in the booth there when I was 18 and 19. And it was quite an amazing formative experience, because it was just people watching turned up to 11. And that neighborhood is very much a part of me and who I am. You know, I feel like I have such an affinity for the streets, the old signs, the memories.
Yeah, you know, I like how go ahead, Gary.
No. I wasn't jumping in. I thought she got cut off. It sounded like she stopped right in the middle of something.
Sorry, I'm still here.
Yeah. Okay. So I like how Roxy is, you know, such a complex character. You know, we meet her ex-boyfriend, her ex-girlfriend. She's still good with both. You know, she lives with her uncle and cares for him. You kind of get the sense that she's still learning who she is and who she wants to be. I just like the complexity of her. Also, if you guys could talk to us about some of the ensemble characters, AJ, Aisha, Nick, you know, the others. I really like AJ and Aisha especially. These are characters who are fully fleshed out with stories of their own that we kind of get caught up with and follow along in the series. Were they inspired by people that you knew?
Yes, all of the characters are. I mean, none of them are really a one-to-one ratio, except, of course, certain famous people like Al Goldstein and Audrey George, you know. But most of the people, including Roxy, you know, Roxy is not 100% me. You know, it's kind of like a Frankenstein process where you take a little bit of this person, a little bit of that person, and sort of weave them together to create new characters.
Yeah. Gary, anything to add?
No, as Chris just said, I mean, I think that was part of the process for us in terms of, you know, when we sat down to hammer out the story. You know, one of the things that you always have to think about, of course, is then, right, not only what's the environment, what's the plot, but who are these people? So how are they shaped by the environment? And then how, in turn, either do they affect the environment, or does the environment, you know, affect them or warp or change them in some way? So I thought, you know, I think that that's the thing we tried to really get to, so that for us, we really talked about, and we would do this as we would, you know, write scenes and advance the page count in the scripts. We would always stop and either we'd talk on the phone, or we'd send notes back and forth via email, just to say, well, you know, is this true to the character? Would the character do this? Would they say this? How would they react? And I think it helped us to then keep a better sense of then, you know, who these people were, how these subplots all sort of at some point kind of dovetail and are put together because of the circumstances in the story.
Yeah. You know, the amount of detail that went into capturing the scene in the visual medium like this is amazing. You know, what I think of is like establishing shots. They're so rich. You have the old movie posters, you know, the Midori billboards, the trashy streets, X's on the windows, graffiti, sneakers hanging from the power lines. You know, the punk scene is still there. I think of, you know, Nick's apartment, tattered furniture, music equipment, Uncle Leo's with the pills kind of spilled out on the table, the Broadway poster, the piano. You know, it's so well done visually. You know, how much influence did you have on the look of the art in the comics, and how much of that was left up to the artist, Andrea Camerini?
Well, it was a combo because, I mean, I'm the first one to admit that I was a little bit of a pest on this because, yes, I'm the G-string Nazi of this project. You know, hike that G-string all the way up to the rib cage. Thank you. But because of the fact that it was autobiographical and so many of these streets are places where I grew up, and so, you know, little details were so ingrained in my mind, and I wanted to share those with people who are too young, you know, or for whatever reason never experienced that era the way that I did. And, you know, Andrea, the reason why we chose him as an artist was because of the fact that he has this incredibly realistic, gritty street scene ability. We had auditioned another artist who was much more stylized. And I realized that, really, I didn't want Sin City.
Yeah.
I want New York City.
Yeah.
I didn't want an artificial, stylized film noir. Now, I'm a huge film noir fan, but that's not this project. This project is real. It has to feel real. It has to feel gritty, authentic, so that people who grew up there like I did will see these subway stops and broken windows and sneakers hanging from the poles and go, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a funny thing. I mean, you know, when you know, comics is such a visual medium, and it is always about trying to marry the right artist to the script or to the story and the look and feel, and how does that come across? I mean, you know, here's Andrea Camerini, who is like, you know, Italian. I mean, Italian. The guy lives in Italy, forget. You know what I mean? So it's not like he used to even live in the States. Because of photo references stuff and the notes that Krista would send, it really helped to really shape what he put down on the panels.
Yeah, it's so well done. I've never said this about a comic before, but you know, some of these panels might be the better term.
Yeah, but they're shots.
Yeah. They're almost Scorsese-like. You know, there's so much going on in the background.
Oh, yeah.
And I like, definitely
in the back of my mind.
Oh, I can see that, yeah. And, you know, there was even one panel where Aisha and Roxy are in the background talking while, you know, there's random passersby in the foreground. You know, those visuals are just so rich. It's so well done.
Well, but it really is a testament to his work because, you know, having done a few titles, man, you know, let me tell you something. Sometimes you get notes from artists, man, because they're like, "Hey, I can't draw this. I don't know what you're talking about. Change, you know, whatever. Change it." Because you know they're storytellers too, so they have a way. You know, they're working with the medium. They have a way to tell the story. But he really hung in with us, man, and really, you know, and it does. It just really comes across.
Yeah, it's greatness. I mean, I just the gritty, dirty kind of feel of that, you know, city at that time, you know, before gentrification. I mean, it's just it's about as noir as you can get in, you know, the modern era. Now the sexual nature, you know, the characters and the settings are, you know, they're front and center in the stories, absolutely crucial to the plot. but the sex doesn't feel overplayed. In fact, I mean, there were some seedy details, you know, thrown in, like passing the money through the paper on the edge of the glass. The guy's tie flipped over his shoulder, and probably my favorite was the
All of that.
Yeah, and you know, the window washer guy, probably my favorite. Would you say you were going for something authentic here, and maybe not necessarily sexy? What were you going for with that?
Well, we were definitely. I mean, the thing that people have to understand is that sex work is work. It's a job, you know, and it can be sexy, but it's not. It's a job. It's you sell hot dogs. You work in a factory. You do your job, and you know that kind of very businesslike day.
Did we lose Krista?
Can you not hear me?
There you are.
Well, you faded out for a second.
I think
there.
You faded out there for a second.
It wasn't my imagination before. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't have the best connection here at this apartment. But no, what I was trying to say is that I wanted to share those little intimate, realistic details of what our day-to-day lives were like, because so many stories that are told about sex workers and peep girls and strippers are told from the point of view of the man watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to reverse the camera and tell the story from our side of the glass.
Wow. Yeah. You capture that for sure. And those details just give it that air of authenticity. It feels real. You know, I like female protagonists in the crime noir genre. I like them so much. I've written 5 books about one, you know, and to me, it feels like it, you know, breaks with cliche, you know, adds maybe a wider emotional palette to work with. But I'm curious to know your thoughts about women protagonists, you know, what they bring to this genre.
Well, I don't like to really think protagonists are magic or special or different. We're people, you know, and you know, there's a spectrum, because I also write masculine of censor characters like AJ, you know, who is a woman, but she identifies differently as far as her gender presentation. So I don't like to say, I don't like to put people in those categories. And I think that it's fall into either overly simplistic or kind of fetishized attitude towards female characters, when, you know, characters are characters. You know, and they should all be deep and complex and interesting and original and themselves.
Yeah, no, I'll just say this as the old guy. I mean, for sure, I think it is right. It is always about, you know, I guess I sort of harp on this with my, you know, my students in Antioch, and I admonish myself too to always try to do this, which is the, you know, however we can try to get into the skin of the other person, whoever they are, younger, older, race, ethnicity, what have you, and as Krista said, I mean, everybody's more complex than you think they are. I put it another way, everybody's as complex as you think you are. I guess that's really the point, right? So that if I keep that sort of dictum in my mind, in my head, then even I'm writing a corrupt character, whoever they are, even understanding that they have certain motivations, they have certain things that are driving them to do what they do. And I think if you can sort of keep that in mind and give some hint of that, then the more rounded that character is, and the more dimensional I think they'll come across, you know, to the reader.
Exactly, and I think
there's
notion of POV, you know, the notion that women are observed and men are actors, you know, and I really love being able to turn that around, you know, and say, well, no, we're all the star of our own show, we're all the protagonists, and, you know, to take away that notion of the male gaze and to really tell our stories, the stories of marginalized characters who are living on the fringe, like the characters in Peepland.
Exactly.
Well said. Yeah. Characters are individuals, and Yeah, I like that. And these are people who are, you know, on the margin, but they have such compelling stories. They're in bad situations. They don't have great options. And you can't not follow them through this story. On that note, you know, about how each character is a complex person, I want to go back to that. I call him the window washer guy, but the maintenance guy, I can't remember his name, but
Fabrice?
I get the sense, you know, he's, say again?
Fabrice.
Fabrice?
Yes, yes. So
yeah,
I get the sense he's more than just a, you know, two-dimensional character there in the background. There's definitely something going on with him. We see him flashing back in his, you know, memory to, you know, maybe in another country, some things going on. Can you talk about that guy and his role in the story? I'm very curious.
He's Haitian,
okay.
Yeah. Chris should talk about this, but yeah, he was with the he has a lot of there's sins in his past, and he hasn't lived them down, and he was part of Papa Doc's infamous Tonton Macoute. So he was not a nice guy, and in some ways the past always catches up. So the past catches up to him, but also then is the engine that propels him to do what he does. I don't want to give it away, but do what he does toward the end of B Plan.
Well,
okay.
Yeah, and also,
yeah. I kind of.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. We want to hear you. Krista, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think I might be dropping out. I'm so sorry about having this terrible signal here.
Oh, okay.
What I was going to say is that, you know, part of, for one thing, there actually was a maintenance guy who worked for about 2 weeks in the booths where I was working, who was Haitian, who had a big scar on his face, and he just was a brick wall. Like, you couldn't, no matter how friendly you tried to be to him, he just taciturn, had no, you could not get through to him. And I always wondered what his story was, but, you know, 2 weeks later he moved on to something else and I never found out. You know, so this is kind of like my tribute to whoever that guy was. I never even learned his name. You know,
yeah.
But also,
yeah, so.
Larry and I joked when we first created that character, we were joking about wanting to subvert the cliche of the magic Negro. You know, the idea of that sort of Stephen King character, some kind of magical, mystical guy, like, makes white people like awesome. as a kind of like a...
Uh-oh. We lost you again, Jan.
I think we...
Are you still there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost part of what you were saying.
You faded there.
I'm so sorry, you guys.
That's all right.
What
it's all good.
Said? I don't even know.
Go back. You should reel it back a little bit about the you were making the Stephen King allusion, the magical Negro part.
Ah, yes, that's right. Like the Green Mile, where you have a black character who basically just exists to enlighten white people, you know, but doesn't have any inner life himself, you know, and... So, and I had thought, like, here's this unusual Haitian guy who comes into this, you know, white girl's life. You know, he's a magical Negro. Well, no, he's actually a really terrible person. But, you know, in a good way.
In a good way. That's right. In a good way.
Yeah.
Or he tries to make
amends.
I
think that's what makes this. Yeah. That makes this story so much richer than what you might expect, because each character has depth. You know, they have a story, and they all play a role in this story. So the fifth, and I think it's the last volume, is due out very soon, right? I think.
Yes.
I'd love to see more of this. You know, are there any plans in the works for you to do work on something like this again in the near future?
Well, funny you should mention. We did come up with a concept for a continuing story. See, the thing with P Peepland is that it's a natural for a series because, you know, girls come and go, workers come and go, stories come and go, clients come and go, you know, and it's a great way to kind of branch off into, you know, there's, you know, 6 million stories in the Naked City. This is one of them.
Exactly. Well, and funny enough, this is actually before there was the Netflix show The Get Down, which was about, you know, the birth of hip hop. Because this, remember, this is happening at this same time period. So one of the stories, which was branching out of Peepland, was in fact to sort of take us into, you know, the Bronx and some of the other areas we didn't touch upon in this story, and to look at the hip hop scene that's also happening, that's going down in New York at the same time. Maybe in some form or another we'll be able to do something with that, I think, at some point.
Yeah, that would be
the fantastic. And you're right, you know, there's so much you could do with this. And you've got such complex characters already there. Will you be releasing, is Titan Hard Case Crime, are they going to release a 5 issues in one volume to collect the entire series? No.
Yes. That'll be out in June.
Yeah, it'll be out in June, I think, yeah. So it's actually coming out pretty soon after the final issue drops.
Yeah, I think I actually knew the answer to that before I asked it, because I've pre-ordered that.
All right.
Make sure that everybody knows.
That's it. That's right.
So what? Yeah, get your hands on it. Get these now. I like the collectible covers. Everything about this series. What new and exciting projects are you each working on these days that we can look forward to from each of you?
There's
a possible joint project we're working on together again, but we can't say what it is because, you know, we don't want
to
jinx it. So, right. So Chris should just say what solo
okay.
project she's working on, then I'll jump in.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm working on a third Angel Dare book. That's the third book in the series, following my protagonist, who's a former porn star. And the first book was Money Shot, second is Chokehold, and the third one will be called The Get Off, and it is set in the world of rodeo bullfighters.
Oh, wow, nice.
Yeah, there you go.
And Gary, how about you?
Oh, I've got another comics project. It's going to be a while before. I've written the script now, and it's going to be a while before my buddy Dale Barry, who's a fantastic artist, we'll be getting the pages done, but essentially it's set, I guess I'm going further back in time, it's set in the late 50s, and it involves the inspiration for the three main characters were three sort of black pioneers in comics, and one of the characters is a woman based on Jackie Orms, who was the first black woman to have her own syndicated strip, Torchy Brown. And, you know, there's a Red Scare, there's civil rights is brewing, all this stuff is percolating. One of the other characters is a Korean War vet and race relations. Anyway, it's all a heady mix, and it's called the Bebop Barbarians.
Oh, very nice. So where's the best place that people can find you out there on the web, you know, keep up with you? As these projects come to fruition?
Well, I mean, you can go to ChristaFaust.com. That's kind of a hub that will lead you off to the various social networks and other ways of connecting information about new projects.
Yeah, and unlike our president, like, I don't tweet, man. But I do have a website. It's gdphillips.com, and that may not lead you anywhere, but that's okay with me. But you know, every once in a while, I put something up. keep it current occasionally.
Very, very cool. Well, Krista and Gary, you know, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to us about your work. It's been great having you on. Would love to do this again as this other mysterious project you're working on comes about. Just let me know.
Yes. Yes, we will, Greg. Yes, we will.
All right. Thanks so much. And for the listeners, I encourage you, if you haven't yet, check out PeePlan. It's a fantastic, gritty noir series, a rich, detailed story filled with the most interesting and complex characters. You don't want to miss out on this. Ask for PeePlan at your local comic shop. Grab them on Amazon like I did. You won't regret it. And while you're in the book buying mood, you know, maybe check out my Selena series. And until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio. And Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC.